My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
Our next guest was a Royal Marine sniper who deployed to Northern Ireland and Iraq in 2003. After a stint working offshore, he now travels to some of the most hostile environments on the planet, working in TV and film. We talk positive habits, human suffering, and our fragile environment. Episode 35, Aldo Kane, this is Declassified. Born in 1977.
Yep.
Childhood.
Are we on?
You were on, mate.
Oh, bollocks.
We are on, and I'm keeping this in. Yeah, look, born in 1977, just on the outskirts of Glasgow, is that right?
Yeah, so I was born in Bells Hill, just outside Glasgow, and then grew up in between East Kilbride and down in Kilwinning, which you've probably never heard of, but it's a small town in the west coast of Scotland, just sort of 40 minutes outside of Glasgow, down by the seaside.
Mm, lovely. What did your mum and dad do?
They both paramedics, so we were brought up with the care and due diligence that two paramedics bring children up. Basically, you get a cut knee, there's absolutely zero sympathy.
Yeah. It's, like paramedics, like if you look at paramedics now, especially in London, yeah. You talk about trauma. Did you ever feel like that was coming into the home?
I mean, there was five of us kids, and mum and dad are both paramedics. I remember vividly sitting round a table, mum and dad talking about specific cases. I remember them talking about which body parts they bagged of a person that got smashed on the railway line near us. And I remember them sort of chatting about that over dinner, which in a weird way, knowing everything that I know about now, about what I've went through, you know, in the military and out of the military on various different jobs, you know, they just crack on and there's no counselling, there's no therapy. I don't know whether it's like that now, but, you know, they're therapy, their sort of counselling back then was chatting about it over dinner.
Well, I suppose it's good that you've got two people there that can relate to it as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, yeah.
And they were happy to speak about that in front of the kids. So there's five of you,
me,
twin brother
Ross, who was in the Marines, same time as me, sister, who was in the Air Force, and two younger brothers, and they're, one's a TV producer, one's an art teacher.
Mm. And they were happy to speak about it in front of the kids as well.
Yeah, I mean, we were young. I joined at 16, so all of those memories of that sort of chat over dinner would have been when I was much younger. But yeah, I guess so. Mm. And they, you know, they would have been instrumental in sort of giving us sort of advice younger about how to do first aid, basic stuff, but, you know, stuff that you probably remember for the rest of your life, whether it's CPR or how to dress a wound, that sort of thing.
Mm. Life skills,
yeah.
Was you learning a lot then, especially around like the seaside? Was you out swimming? What was childhood like in that respect?
So I was in scouts. In fact, my dad was a scout leader, so Ross and I, before we were even old enough to be in the Beavers, we were away with my dad on scout trips, camping trips. So from as young as I can remember, probably 3, 4, 5, we would have been away sort of on scout hikes, scout trips with dad, not specifically in the scouts ourselves, we were too young. And then we went all the way through, so Beavers, Cub Scouts, and obviously I joined the Marines at 16, so didn't get into the ventures that much. So scouting was a huge part of where Ross and I and my family grew up, basically, and also the cadets. We were in the air cadets down in Ardrossan. So we spent a lot of time outside, and that was playing soldiers up in the forest or on a big hill behind where we lived, or it was going on trips over to Arran, climbing Goat Fell up into Glencoe all round. So it was pretty much, you know, brought up on the outside, outdoors.
Did you have a good relationship with your twin brother?
Yeah, great. We shared the room up until I joined up at 16, and then he joined up a couple of years later, and we ended up in the same troop for 3 years.
Did you?
Yeah. So, I mean, we were pretty close.
Why did you join then, 16?
A lot of it, I think, because of the way mum and dad had brought us up. They brought us up in the outdoors. I mean, to have five kids and three of them join the military, you know, that's probably because we enjoyed the outdoors and we enjoyed that adventurous lifestyle. I'm not academic in any way, and you know, school was a drag for me because I knew that I wanted to join the Marines and you know, get off and get travelling. I still remember the careers book with the three guys on the front of it in the jungle, and I was like, yeah, that's amazing. And loads of times through my career, I thought, bloody hell, I'm doing this. I'm in the Marines. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, and it sounds a bit crap saying that now, but you know, as something that I wanted to do from the age of 12, probably or 13, to achieve that, you know, it's still. Yeah, it still makes me happy when I think about it.
Mm. When you're 16 in the Marines, do you still go through exactly the same? Are you in the troop with adults and
you just
it's all the same.
It's all the same except you get paid less. So you're doing the exact same.
Probably more.
You're doing the exact same as everyone else, yeah. And you're getting paid less. I think through training I might have been getting a couple hundred quid a month. And that was the first time you're sort of going out drinking as well, aren't you? And you know, in training, there might be 50 of you, and there's guys up to the age of 30, I guess. Yeah. So at the age of 16, you're quite impressionable. You're sort of dragged up by the core. I didn't have anything to compare it to, so I still think it was easier for me to join at the age of 16 and compare it to being a paper boy than to join at the age of 23, 4 after university or after something, you know, being a mechanic or a teacher or something, because I would have, the type of person I am, I would have probably compared that back to and you know, that may have been the nail in the coffin for me sort of cracking on and getting through training. But again, I don't know, it's one of those things I'd kind of set my mind on it and that was it.
And was that it? Because quite often people run away to do something, but I suppose something like the Marines, like almost a vocation, was you just drawn towards it?
I mean, anyone listening to this that's been in the Corps or similar military backgrounds, you know, you've got all types that you do on Civvy Street, and you've got Torags, you've got career people, you've got people in the middle. And I was just drawn to it for the hardship, I think, looking back. The opportunity to travel and the hardship, how hard it would be, and to test myself physically. And mentally, I guess, and that's kind of like, that's what my graft is now. You know, my work now is hard blooded graft, and it's, you know, I'm not tested against anyone else. Nobody ever sees the work that I do or that gets put into these jobs, and mostly it's just, you know, it's for myself. You know, all the behind the scenes stuff, all that hard graft of getting a job away. It's, you know, that's, I do that for myself, and that's probably what I was doing when I was joining the Marines at 16. I certainly wasn't running away from anything. You know, We had zero to complain about as kids. Didn't have any money, really, but we, you know, there was five of us. We had fun. We were outside loads. Mum and Dad together, you know, there was no issues. You know, there was nothing to run away from.
Yeah.
Had a cracking upbringing. So it was more just...
The adventure.
The adventure, yeah. It's that boy's own, like, growing up reading Commando and that sort of thing. Just sort of like...
Commando's got a lot to answer for.
Yeah, no, it has, yeah. Like, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. So that's basically why. And I think also, at the time, there wasn't a huge amount to do in Ayrshire. Certainly for someone like myself, it didn't seem like there was a lot of job opportunities, and I don't know what I would have done. I mean, my school stuck me on... I went to Co-Winning Academy, and they stuck me on work experience in buttons folding jeans. I told them I wanted to be a sniper in the Marines, and what could they do to sort of help me out there, even if it was like doing some outward bound stuff. But stuck in the mall in Irvine in the shop stacking jeans and t-shirts, you know, that to me is, that's why I make a point now, if I can, and getting into schools and talking to kids about the stuff that I do now, because it's that motivation at that age is so crucial, and I did have it, you know, you know, I had that motivation, but there must be, you know, a lot of people that don't have that, you know, they're just on that knife edge and need a point in the right direction.
I think kids as well, they need one role models, especially young boys need male role models between the age of kind of 14, 15, 19. I got it, you got it in the military, like seeing these guys, like, I want to be that. That's what I want to be. My brother was in as well, so I was like looking up to him. That's where I want to be, that guidance. As well as that kind of the permission base, really, to like say that you can do this, this is how I got there.
Yeah.
Where did you go after training?
So where... so I passed out and went to 40 Commando. So I was young. I guess I was 17 when I then passed out. Went to 40 Commando in Taunton. Joined Alpha Company there and then started to learn what it was like almost immediately to be in the Corps. I went to the guard room, checked in with the corporal. He was like, yep, cool. What's your name? Kane. And he was going down his list and he's like, oh, it says here you have to go in, come back again next Wednesday. I was like, perfect. Get a week off. Anyway, I went home, got a train, spent probably half of my month's wages getting the train back up the line that day. And then on the Monday morning, phone call from Sergeant Major, you better get back here. You're going to be getting done for being AWOL. Day one at 40 Commando. And I was adrift. So I'd spend the rest of my money to come back down that I'd been paid that month. And got back down in my punishment. My first introduction to being at 40 Commando was spending 2 or 3 days cleaning out the donkey bath. There's an old manor there at Norton Manor Camp. And apparently they used to wash the donkeys in this like donkey bath. And it's sort of like individually concreted pebbles that's about 8 feet deep. And so it took about 2 or 3 days to clean all the leaves out of that.
Did you settle in though, right, after that?
Yeah. Joining the Corps was a dream, and you pass out of training and, you know, you get the coveted green beret, and it's one of those things that everyone, you know, sort of that I know from the Corps, that's, you know, it's one of the biggest things you look forward to, and it's such a high failure rate to get to that point, that you do feel sort of top of the pile when you get out, and obviously you're whacked almost immediately back to the bottom of the pile when you join the unit, and that's, you know, that's just the way it is. So I joined Alpha Company, had an amazing time, still in touch with most of the people that I joined up with. That was 94, so what's that, 20-odd years ago? Mm. And that really was those sort of 2 years in Alpha Company, Ocean Wave, sailing around the world. That was Northern Ireland. That was the formative years for me, certainly cemented that I definitely loved the, you know, being in the Corps and that sort of lifestyle.
Where are 40 Commando?
They're in Taunton.
Oh, right, okay.
Norton Manor.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously, the Corps, the Royal Marines, have a few more bases, but they're based in Arbroath, Taunton and Plymouth.
What is it, 40, 40,
42? 40, 40 and 45, yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And what's the role of 40? Is there any specifics?
They don't. It's sort of a bit before my time. It was 45 would have spent most of their time in the Arctic. They would have done belt-fed back-to-back Norways. Big grizzly moustaches and sort of salty sea dogs. 40 Commando, which is where I joined, did a lot of Med and Caribbean trips and jungle training. But across the board, it sort of progressed, and everyone was, you know, everyone was doing everything from mountain training all the way through to, you know, jungles and Arctics. Mm. But the majority of the time that I was at 40, that's what we were doing. We were doing jungle trips, and I guess it's probably one of the most, probably the environment I've worked in most since in TV as well. So it's sort of everything I learned when I was 16, 17, 18 on those early days in the Corps, I'm still using that stuff now.
Sometimes we can scoff at things like what we learn and the value of especially service.
Yeah.
Like what value we have. At the time you think, oh, this is shit. Or yeah. Like, I'm not enjoying this. But the value in it is so important, and it's a real testament to it. You know, this stuff, especially in something like the Marines, where it's highly professional. You're getting skilled,
yeah,
or upskilled all the time and pushed as well.
It's that value and cost. The cost of not doing something, or the cost of never having that opportunity, is probably far outweighs, you know, the value that you get from it. You know, being stuck in, I don't know, we're talking about non-warfare here, so we're talking about exercises, you know, being stuck in the jungle for 30 days on a sort of tactical operational sort of exercise is difficult, hard graft. Anyone that's done it, everyone knows it's hard work. But you really remember that hardship from it. What you remember are the good times.
Mm.
And, you know, same as everything, it's type 2 fun. I've not really come across type 3 fun that much, which is shit at the time and shit afterwards. generally, you know, a lot of the stuff's type 2. It's hard graft at the time, but you look back on it with rose-tinted glasses. And, you know, pretty much everything that I did in the Corps, I use something from that now. And whether that's just the ability to grind on and do 14 trips up and down from the bottom of the volcano to the top in 24 hours, carrying generators out, fuel out and food out, instead of doing 6 one day and 6 the next day. Or, you know, it's just that commando spirit, that sort of determination, that drive to just get the job done.
Yeah, the ability to do it.
Yeah.
Did you stay at Fort?
I was at 40 for 3 years. So I left there in 97, went up to, so I was in recce at 40, then went up to Comatch at the time, which is Fleet Protection Group, so it's subs, Fleet Protection, so of the submarines, which are based up in Faz Lane.
What, and you just protected them there?
Yeah, so we used to go from the camp 4-5 Condor, you'd go across to Faz Lane. And you would do rotations, sort of like being offshore. You'd do 2 or 3 weeks on, 2 or 3 weeks off. So I was this sniper that was in that. So your troop would go over and you would protect a certain area behind the wild, they would call it. And you basically look after the nuclear assets up there. And then from there went down to 4-2, which is where I was on Telic just before I left, and then got out. End of 2003.
Do you know each other, lads from 4-2, 4-5?
Yes. 4-2. Yeah, yeah. So the corps, call it the corps, but the Marines, it's one of those things where you get individually drafted. So everyone's trickle drafted.
Yeah.
And by being trickle drafted, you, I'm not sure if it's done deliberately that way, but what happens is that you're always mixing every 18 months with new people. You're not sort of moving as a troop or as a company through different locations and potentially, I don't know, looking back, maybe breeding complacency or whatever. You know, there's always that trickle of new people bringing new ideas.
We share in best practice, exactly.
Best practice,
you're moving around.
Exactly.
The engineers I was in, there's a lot of that. You move as an individual. But when you get somewhere, you've got your role, whether whatever it is, you know, your trade or a specialist skill.
Yeah.
So when you went to 4-2, it was easy to bed in.
Yeah, you get there and you have... you've got your background, what you've done before, and generally most people, certainly in my experience that you work with, are at the same level as you. You know what you're dealing with, and the you know, the people will graft to the ends of the earth and back again. You know that most people around you are the same as you, so it's quite easy to fit in and to sort of, I guess for me anyway, certainly to fit in and, you know, crack on with
it. When did you do your sniper course?
Did that in end of 97, I think that was.
So you was what, 20 years old? Something?
And with
that, do you do that with just Royal Marines, or do you?
Yeah, so that's
so just a Royal Marine sniper course.
Yeah. The Royal Marine sniper course, as far as I'm aware, is probably one of the hardest to pass in the world. It's quite a lot of self-induced pressure. So many different varying parts of it, and you know, no one's shouting at you, telling you to get stuff done. It's, you know, it's pretty much the pressure's on you to get it done. Shooting is a small part of it. You need to be good at it, but it's quite a small part of it. I think the course is probably 8 weeks or maybe even longer now, and it encompasses everything from camouflage and concealment, vehicle recognition. Bear in mind, this was quite a few years ago I did it.
It's not a test, mate, but
So there's quite a lot of self-induced pressure, but that, weirdly, that's what I wanted to do from when I was a kid. I watched that Tom Berenger sniper film, and I was just like, maybe it was after, I can't remember, but anyway, I kind of, as a kid, had it in my head that that's what I wanted to be, and weirdly, within a few years, I'd done it. I'd sort of become a sniper, and now looking back on that, actually through the rest of my life, I've realised that these things that we think about, this is sort of life lessons when I'm talking to the kids in school, these life lessons that I try to pass on, is that we become what we think about. It's the one thing that I tell all these kids, like, if you can take away one thing from this, is that you become what you think about. And that's interesting when you think about it, is that most people probably aren't thinking about what they're thinking about, and we're potentially our own worst critics. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't have this. And so when I look back on it, that was one of the first examples of me actually doing that without having been taught how to do it. But just that, having a goal, breaking that goal down, and really sort of like working towards that.
Mm. I mean, goal setting is so important.
It's so important. And I think in the Marines, certainly in the military, you're always drafted, like we were chatting about, every 18 months. And you're on this course and you're on that course and you've got that, and then you're on promotion, and then you're on this course, then promotion. It's sort of set out, and it gives you that structure to do that. And when you leave, it took me quite a while to work it out, but I then realised that I had to start doing that. I had to start structuring my life and giving myself these goals and these targets that I suppose I would have had in the Marines. You know, I want to do this course. I can't do that until I've done this. Okay, I need to book this course, this training. I need to be at that level of mountaineering or that level of diving to then be able to offer that service to that industry. And I guess it's that structure and the goal setting part of it is so important. And one of the biggest lessons, I think, on the goal setting side is just to write it down. That's so many people say, oh, I was going to do that and I was going to do this, and you know, before they know it, they've forgotten what they were going to do anyway. But if you've written it down, the only person you're kind of deceiving is yourself. And it's much easier when you've written something down to then break it down and then to realize that pretty much everything on earth is achievable. Anything that you want, you can get there. It's just a matter of, do you have enough time to do it, and have you got enough resources to be able to do it? The rest of it is going to happen.
So Christmas leave 2002, so the end of 2002, Christmas leave. Did you go on Christmas leave? Do you remember? That was just before Talik.
Yes, I did, yeah. I was supposed to be going skiing, if I remember.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, because I went on Christmas leave at the same time as you, so we'd gone on Christmas leave,
yeah.
Come back.
And went straight to...
And then it all kicked off.
Went straight to Kuwait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was that, February?
I think we go out end of Jan, I think. Yeah.
And then... You talk about preparing, you talk about goal setting. Now it's a time where we didn't know when we were going to come back. We didn't know what we was doing out there.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you was, I suppose, in a great position to be there? Did you feel like you was going to go and do a job?
Yeah. I think I learned a lot looking back. I didn't at the time, weirdly, you know, at the time I'm young and you're cracking on, you're just getting on with the job. But when, and sort of retrospectively looking back and trying to make head and tail of it all, I suppose I sort of realised that I was ready. You know, whenever you're in a situation and it's happening, you're as ready as you're ever going to be, because actually there's no other choice, so you may as well be ready. And I think that's pretty much my attitude now. You know, half the times I go out on a job and I'm there, and yes, you know, people watching stuff on television will go, I can do that better, I could do that better, I would have done that differently, I would have done that differently. But, you know, it's me at that time. I'm working with the resources I've got, and I'm human and I'm making mistakes the same as everyone else. And that's as best as I was at that time, because that's what I did.
Mm.
You know, that's
and
it.
And I'm doing it.
And I'm doing it. You know, and that's it. You know, and there's, you know, there's a, you know, when we went out on Telic, We could have spent ages getting ready, but I guess that's the whole point about being spearhead or being ready when you're in the fighting companies, is that you're continually in a state of readiness.
Was everyone up for it?
Yeah, then, yeah, mm. God, yeah. Because, I mean, the Corps, I mean, it's, in comparison, you know, I feel like I've done next to nothing. And, you know, since what's happened, obviously we've had Afghan and all the rest of it and that's been going on since then, and 15 years of fighting. So it's been a small part in comparison, but you know, everyone that I knew was up for that. There was, you know, I liken it to being a fireman and never having gone to a fire, to a real fire. And, you know, there's, yeah, I don't know. It's a weird one. I was ready for it, and it certainly, having only been, I think we were there, what, 6-7 months. You know, it's had quite a big impact on the rest of my life from then. Whether that's decision making or whether that's, you know, making me antsy and not able to sort of chill my beans and just have like a normal job and just settle down. I'm not entirely sure. But either way, it's, you know, everyone was ready. And I'm not sure they were ready then for the next 15 years of fighting. But certainly from my experience, what did we have? 5-6 months, something over there. And yeah, it was, I was ready.
I mean, there wasn't, again, there wasn't much time before kind of in brackets war was declared. And we crossed the border of Kuwait to Iraq. Was it like 20th of March, something like that?
Yeah, 20th, 21st of March.
Yeah,
it was 20th March. Yeah.
Crossed. And what was your role then as soon as you crossed?
I was sniper in Lima Company, Fall 2 Commando. So we went across onto the Al-Faur Peninsula, and we were backstop on the Al-Faur Peninsula for a few days there. And then we pushed on up into Basra. We were up in Basra for the rest of the time there. Meanwhile, 40, I think, if I can remember correctly, we're coming up from the south. I'll probably be corrected here.
Yeah, no, it's all right.
But yeah, so it was a proper proper commando manoeuvre, I guess, proper sort of air, sea and land.
Was you fighting in Basra?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you fight up to Basra, did you?
We went up to, yeah, we all the way up, I can't remember the names, Abu al-Kasib and up and then into Basra, and then we were in Basra at the palace for I can't remember how long we were there. But and so that's when we were up there and then we left. So would that have been July or something?
We left before that. We left in, I think, May or June.
Yeah.
We was outside. But war fighting in Basra itself, because I can remember being on the outside because we were blowing stuff up, like all the munitions that were left and the tanks and everything. But then we'd start setting up Shaiba log base, as it was known then, or the Shaiba air base, which was outside. Yeah. And all the artillery were firing flares in.
Yeah.
And then all you lot were going around the city doing whatever you were doing.
Yeah.
Was your role then as a sniper within the city?
Within Lima Company, we were, at one point we then, it's all a bit hazy, we then went up and helped 40 Commando, who I think were scrapping up at Abu al-Kasib or somewhere up around there. Is that the name of it? And then also working with the Dragoon Guards, with the tanks were up there. I can't remember.
Yeah. But was you, and what I'm getting at there is, was you an actual sniper pulling the triggers?
Yeah, yeah. So we, you know, we didn't have a lot of fighting, but in, you know, we did. Yeah, exactly.
Did that affect you, or was there anything else within that Talik campaign that affected, like, your worldview, like your outlook?
Yeah, I think, of course, that's going to be difficult for anyone is to do this sort of pulling trigger bit. I think more though for me, it was more just the entire situation of being there. You know, you sort of train for so many years to be a commando, to be doing this job, and you go out there, and I suppose you're, and I've certainly say this again, I've seen next to nothing in comparison to what's happened since then. But I suppose for me at that time, and then having left shortly afterwards, you know, to be involved in that situation, and then say, or for example, burying people, you know, at the side of the road, that, you know, that's that sort of thing. I don't think it affected me in a way that was like, that I would class as bad. I think what it did is when I came back, it sort of forced me into this like hyperdrive of trying to be better, self-development, personal development, trying to I think what it did was it cemented that life was at best fragile, and at best short. And I think that's what then gave me the drive when I came out to be continually pushing, in fact almost not settling. And so it probably took all the sort of interpersonal attributes that I had before and sort of stuck them on steroids, really, for when for when I got out, in that drive to not end up like, I don't know, the people that were burying at the side of the road or whatever. Looking back now, the same as I look on everything, would class it completely positive. You know, you take the positives from as much as you can and you make the best with that. And certainly, you know, I've a lot of friends that obviously then stayed on further and did much, much more in the Corps and, you know, with Afghan and, you know, it feels ridiculous even sort of chatting about that. But it, you know, it's you know, for me and my story and for my life, that was, you know, that was certainly a massive foundation building block.
Well, I think Telequiz is a very strange one, very short,
yeah,
very quick,
yeah.
And then almost a bit of an anticlimax towards the end of it, and it heated up later on. But the, you know, I think you hit on something like growth and development because of trauma and conflict. How are you going to get better from this instead of dwelling? And some people, they have to do that, but there also is a way out. So, but, and yours then went into, you know, what you're doing now, and there's been many steps before we got there. But why did you leave them? Was the decision made before Telic?
So I think I put my notes in before and was just getting out of that time. And it was because I joined at 16. I joined at 16, wanted to get out before I got too old to then do something else, so that I then had the backstop of joining back up again. So it was sort of fail-safe. And I figured if I got out at 25, 26, if I didn't like it outside, then I could get back in and, you know, if they took me, could get back in and, you know, then have a career. You know, my brother stayed on and did a huge amount more years than I did. But at the time I was like, I've joined at 16, I'll get out, I'll get into adventure training, because that's where my life was going. I was spending a lot of my leave in the Marines before, obviously, Telic and that, doing climbing, mountaineering, outdoors. That's what I joined the Marines for.
Civilian stuff. Not
so much civilian qualifications, but doing it, you know, climbing, going mountaineering, going paddling. And so that's, you know, that was the main drive for me to join up, was that side of it. And so I started doing quite a lot of that adventurous training. And that, you know, that was going to be my plan when I got out, was to go and work in an adventurous training sort of outdoor sort of facility in the UK somewhere. And then when I did get out and want to do that, I realised that was unsustainable, sort of cash-wise and job-wise. It was never going to happen.
Is that how you ended up door-to-door salesman for electricity?
Yeah. So I'd obviously left the Marines, and then I was finishing off a uni course, which was just evenings. It was an access course because I didn't know what to do, and I thought, you know, maybe go to college or something and get some quals, because I'd left to join the Marines through my GCSE, so I didn't have any. I took this job. It was the first job interview that I did when I left the Marines, and I went for a job interview, just finished being a sniper in Iraq, and I'm wearing a suit and tie, just been shat on by a seagull on the way into the interview, all down my face, front of my D-mob suit. And I went in and they made me do the chicken dance and a few other things, because it was like sales. And they so I ended up, I just came out of there sort of embarrassed, demotivated, and just feeling a bit sad. I got the job, but really it was selling electricity door to door. You know, I was going around Dundee for 6 months banging on doors, asking people if they wanted to change their electricity over, and that was tough. You know, it was tough because I wasn't making any money, because I don't like lying, and effectively that's what I was having to do, was lie to people about their electricity suppliers, and so I didn't make any money. I was making 200-300 quid a month doing that, absolute max. So it was kind of unsustainable. I ended up having a tantrum in the, I think guy had slammed the door in my face and told me to F off, and I think I ripped almost all of my uniform off and threw it at his door and left it in his garden, and then I had to walk back to my car with basically no clothes on and drive 2 hours home.
Well, no clothes, you know, there's been a lot of pictures of you with no clothes on recently. We'll get to that point. But like, for your mental health, going from being someone with high status, high regard, to being quite, I'm not disrespecting a sales job, but there is a big difference. And was your self-worth affected by that?
Yeah, massively. I think your self-worth in a way is affected when I'm speaking for just myself. When I left the Marines, I felt like when I was walking into a pub or somewhere that I was very much on my own. you know, before when you're in the Corps, you walk into a pub, you've got a strength of 10 men, you know, metaphorically speaking, you've got 1,000 blokes behind you. So you're part of that group or that Corps, you know, and that, I think human nature wise, we feel better when we're part of clubs, and that's why we have clubs and syndicates and, you know, that sort of thing. So, and you lose that, and you kind of, you know, and we all chat about it, but you lose that direction and that point, and I think it becomes quite difficult to refocus and to then become back in command and control of your own life in a way. It's, you know, you can have, if you're not careful, it's very easy to slip.
How did you get yourself out of it then?
That job wasn't great for me, doing the gas and electricity stuff. It wasn't great for my, you know, you're getting the door slammed in your face probably 10 times a day. So you're already dealing with rejection on a big way. And then you're dealing with the fact that you used to be somebody and, you know, in the Marines, and people knew you and liked you. So it took a very, I then did a massive sort of right turn, on my resettlement, I did rope access courses and NDT, non-destructive testing for the offshore industry. But I'd sort of been putting it off going offshore because I wanted to see if I could get this uni course done. And then I just thought, this isn't working, you know, doing that gas and electricity stuff. You know, there was no jobs in the outdoor industry and no money in it. So I then ended up going offshore, up into the North Sea, doing 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off rope access work, non-destructive testing. And that was the turning point where I sort of then started to realise that it was me that was, you know, it was only going to be me that got myself out of any holes or got myself into them. You know, I pretty much, the situation I was in at that point before I went offshore was completely down to me. There was no one else to blame. And that's quite a good point to start with, is that really, you know, you can spend a lot, regardless of what's happened, you can spend a lot of time and energy blaming other people and situations and governments and organisations, but really, you know, these things happen, shit happens, and we're allowed to swear. These things happen, and it's how we react to them and how we deal with them that then determines what happens afterwards. So the same thing could happen to you and the same thing could happen to me. The car breaks down. Because the way you look at life potentially and what's happened to you in the past, that's, you might almost take that as a personal insult to you. Whereas for me or for someone else, they might go, oh, the car's broke down, I'll get it fixed. And, you know, the same thing happens, but it's two completely different outlooks on the situation, and that can have a knock-on effect. And I suppose when you're on your own and you don't have anyone to slap you out of that, it then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where you're at the top of the incident pit and you're sort of the grains of sand.
Accountability is so important as well to yourself. Are you stubborn? In a good way, in a positive way.
I'm not entirely sure. I probably am, yeah.
With yourself?
Yeah, with myself, I'm pretty bad. I've got quite high standards with the stuff that I do. You know, I say that I've got high standards. I basically am average at best at most things I do, even, you know, in the Corps and, you know, all the rest of it, and barely scraping through training at 16 and sniper course. You know, at best, I'm average at that stuff, but I still have fairly high standards for myself. And it was, I suppose, before I went offshore, I just felt like I was sort of marking time. So exactly like you say, accountability, I then felt like I had to be, if no one else was going to make sure I was all right, so I had to then start making sure that I was all right. And I suppose that sort of came through with, you know, like when I was offshore, I then started to do courses and book myself onto courses, and the more, and it's almost like a knock-on effect, you know, the more things that you do, the more doors that are opened.
So you're doing 2 weeks away offshore,
yeah,
but getting practical, doing all the line, yeah, work, all the access work,
exactly,
and then the money you was earning from that,
yeah,
developing yourself in your 2 weeks,
exactly,
off.
And so I chucked a lot of money into courses and training, and which, you know, I should have probably stuck it into a house or something. But at the time I was thinking, because I'd come back from Iraq and I, you know, in my head, it was like personal development, and it was, you know, I figured I would never begrudge the money that I spent on education because I didn't have one from school, and the only education I would ever get myself was self-taught, was stuff that I had, you know, either paid for or taught myself.
So an amazing base with the Royal Marines, doing everything you've done there. The resettlement you used, access, so yeah, a lot of rope work, all that kind of rigging and all yeah, everything. And then getting a lot of experience, I'm summarising by the way, yeah, right? So yeah, a lot of experience being on offshore, but then when you're coming back, you're then doing more adventure training qualifications, exactly, little by little. How long was you away for? How long was you doing
That for? So I was doing that for probably 3 or 4 years, and then I set up my own company doing rope access the same, but more land-based. So I did that all together for probably 7 or 8 years. I mean, it took me up to 2010, 11, something like that.
Well, let's go 2010, because then the BBC knocks yep, on your door. Yep. What was that about?
So a friend of mine ran a safety company, and they sort of asked me to come down and have a meeting with them. BBC had asked them if they could get them inside a volcano, an active volcano in the Congo. Obviously, I said yes immediately.
I mean, it's the only logical thing.
Yeah, exactly. Never been in the Congo before, never been in a volcano before, but I was like, yeah, I can definitely do that. Looking back now, that job was the culmination of prior planning, preparation, all the rest of that stuff. When you're ready for, you know, when you're ready for something, the opportunity presents itself. Mm. Instead of me waiting for that job to come along, then I was getting ready for that job, not knowing that job was there. It sounds like hocus pocus shit.
No, that's true, yeah.
But effectively, you know, no one's going to help me get that job, and I'm only going to get that job if I'm at the ability, you know, if I'm at that level in the marketplace to offer that service. And that's exactly what happened. The two things sort of came at the right time. And that's effectively what I did. I put a plan together. We flew out to the Congo. We got, it was still fairly rough at the time, actually, down there in eastern Goma.
What was the main objective? Why was you going to this volcano?
It was to get inside it. And then it's the biggest lava lake on Earth. It's hundreds of meters wide. Mm. And it's pretty tough to get to because of where it is. Eastern Congo, DRC, has been over the years, can be pretty interesting, spicy. And then obviously it's a volcano, so all the normal risks associated with biggest lava lake on Earth and being inside a volcano. And so we put the plan together, and we cracked on, and we got the film crew down inside it. We filmed this big lava lake, and then we got everyone back out safe. And that's when, I mean, that up until that point, yeah, I still find it weird now. Up until that point, I'd never been brought up with television. I'd never watched television. And it never crossed my mind that television was made, weirdly, if you know what I mean. That sounds a ridiculous thing to say, but it was like a thing that people watched. Yeah, it was there. I think nowadays, young people are very much aware that there's television, there's YouTube, there's, you know, Instagram. You know, I'm having to catch up with that now.
There's a process, isn't
there? Yeah. So it then, you know, this penny dropped when I did that job, and I was like, everything that I learned in the military that I thought was so useless on Civvy Street has never been more useful. That's, you know, everything that I learned in the Marines was directly transferable into television. And it was like, bang, penny drops. It was like, hang on, there's people going to extreme, remote, hostile places. These, also to put it into perspective, these guys are super experienced. You know, all these guys are filming, directing, producing backwards while everyone else is doing their stuff. You know, they're going down the rock face backwards whilst filming. And so, you know, these guys are super experienced, but they do need looking after. And that sort of that military background helps with that. It's whether it's the security part of it or whether it's the technical part of it. So everything that I had done in my spare time from being offshore added together and bolstered this sort of military sort of security side of it. You then get to this point where you're able to look after a crew and to take 10 people or so inside an active volcano and do 5, 6, 7 days filming, come back out and everyone's good and you've got a good film in the can, then, you know, that's...
Yeah, I suppose as well, because that's quite a big job, is it? It's not like that's run-of-the-mill. You know, this stuff's not happening on a daily basis. It's quite a one-off.
Yeah.
Did you then become sought after, or did you then still have to chase work after that?
No, I mean, I did that and I didn't do anything else for 6 months, and that was, 10 years ago now, right? So it's just at the infancy of sort of adventure television. And I suppose that was, it was my step into it, but there wasn't very much other work, and I didn't do anything else for another 6 months. I took Helen Skelton up to the top of Salisbury Cathedral Spire was the next job, and changed the light bulb up there for Blue Peter. So I did that. So it was quite a very slow, very organic time to transfer from doing... I was still doing at the time rope access, so I was fitting in my life offshore on the wind turbines, on bridges, and then doing bits of television work. So I was grafting like 3 or 4 jobs trying to make it all work. And I should say this type of work will go away equally as fast as it arrived. You know, it's, you know, for me, I'm under no illusion this work, you know, could potentially dry up, you know, this year, next year, whenever it is. But it then became clear that all of the skills and assets that I had, as well as that good core ethos of just getting on with it and helping people and don't be a dick. You know, the biggest thing that you can do in this industry is just don't be a dick. Help people. You never know when you're going to need help yourself, certainly on expeditions anyway. Mm. And so that kind of, you know, it took a couple of years, 3-4 years to sort of doing occasional jobs while still working the other jobs to then get to a point where I could then offer all of these services, whether it was diving or skydiving or whatever it is for the television and film industry.
So where are you going now then? Because you work with Steve Backshaw a lot.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing with him then?
Steve, Steve Backshaw is television naturalist. I mean, he's the oracle of everything wildlife based. Your kids have probably seen him on Deadly 60.
Yeah.
He's an outdoor man, you know, he's an adventure man, he's sort of kayaker, climber. And about 5 years, I think it was, 5 years ago, he asked me if I would come and help on one of their expeditions out in Venezuela. So we went out and we tried to put a new route up at one of the tepuis, one of the big sandstone cliffs. It was a two-part thing for the BBC. And we, you know, Steve and the team are going to climb it and my job really is to be sort of medic.
Was that when it was all falling down?
Yeah,
the blokes,
all the rocks.
Like, yeah.
And my job really is to be the bootneck there and sort of like lift and carry bags and pillowcases, be the medic, be the butt of all jokes and the morale and the person that sort of like keeps everyone together and looks after them from a safety point of view. And that's what we did. And then we abseiled Angel Falls, which was amazing. Mm. But again, like we're in the jungle. Steve's super capable. He doesn't need, actually most of the crews that we work with are super capable. They don't need any support really, but it's just organising everything in case the shit hits the fan, then you've got a system of getting someone out if they get injured or whatever. So we did, Steve and I did that. I'd been doing lots of safety work across the board, whether it was that Driven to Extremes thing with Tom Hardy, Henry Cavill and Adrian Brody. So we did that, driving across. It was a driving program for Discovery and then lots of other things, caves, One Strange Rock. And it was all leading up to, we then did Steve's expedition series and off the back of that, we got another commission to do another expedition series where we went out to Papua New Guinea. Steve had wanted to paddle this river and we went out and did a 5-6 week expedition there, again for the BBC. And then off the back of that, Steve got this recent commission called Expedition, which we've just finished filming. So it's 10 world firsts.
Is Steve, and I suppose you as well, are you the go-to people for when it's fucking hard? when it's not been done before, especially with TV, are you two like world leading then? Or you and your team, world leading in the ones that they go to?
Adventure television has changed over the years, and it goes, there's so many different genres. There's stuff on Discovery, there's stuff on Nat Geo, there's stuff on BBC. Every channel has their own take on what something is. Some stuff can be highly produced, some stuff can be fly on the wall, this is what happens. And so what, you know, Steve's very open about it, that, you know, he'll, if he's going to fail at something, then he'll fail. If he's not good enough, then he's not good enough, you know. And the production companies that we work with to do these are showing everything, you know, and sometimes we fail at what we're doing. Like in Venezuela, we didn't do the climb. And that was quite novel, I think, at the time for people to see that, you know, we aren't always successful on
expedition. Yeah, the honesty of it.
Yeah, and things go wrong and, you know, this is what's and all. And so we, the expedition series is all world first, and it's a hard graft. You know, I don't think there's anyone else really that's making television that's spending, you know, Steve's a mainstream presenter, and he's sleeping out in the jungle for 6 weeks. You know, at a time we did Suriname, we were every night in hammocks in the jungle on the move, not stopping in the same place twice, and with a film crew in tow, all the battery charging, all the, you know, the rushes downloads, just like, it's such a big operation. It's been condensed over the 10 expeditions.
I mean, logistically it sounds like a nightmare.
It's hard work, and we've got an amazing team, True to Nature in Bristol, the production company, and the producers and directors there. I mean, they're spending a year and a half getting all this organised. So by the time Steve and I hit the ground, we've actually had, I mean, I say that, they've had probably about a year max prep, and then we went back to back on 10 expeditions of about 3 to 4 weeks each, maybe 5 weeks. So once Steve and I hit the ground, it's the best part of it's already done, as in the planning, the prep, the helicopter flights, planes, food, logistics, medical, Casivac, you know, there's, and all the content that Steve's got to deliver on wildlife, environmental stuff. You know, there's just so many areas to it, and it's a bit of a...
They say environment dictates performance. Do you think, like 4-2, and then getting out, do you think that this is an environment where you're thriving in? Where it's lifting you? Being around people like Steve and the producers and the directors?
Yeah, I think, yeah, very much. The team that we are working with is probably one of the best teams in the world for making this type of television. We do it all very, it's high tech, but it's, everyone has three jobs. And this is what we're, you know, it's almost why it's so similar to being in the Marines, because we've got small teams operating in, not hostile, but we're operating in extreme remote locations around the world. And as it is in the Corps, you've got to know the next guy up's job and the guys on either side of your job. Like if you're in the recce team, you know, you've still got to be able to know how to use the radio, and you've got to be able to be medic, you know, if you're doing another job, or someone gets taken out. So it's that distilling everyone's skills and then sharing them out so that, you know, so you end up with a very small team that's very highly trained, operating to, you know, to get the best.
How did you end up in a nuclear bunker under the ground? Because this is something that fascinates me. I don't watch too much TV, but this was one of the things where I was like, we talk about human suffering.
Yeah.
Explain why it's that. How are you?
Yeah, so last year was a mega year. We had these 10 expeditions with Steve. I also went head-to-head with Ed Stafford on a job out in the mangroves in Borneo. And then there was this other job that I did in between, I think it was Mexico and Greenland, but it was a Horizon experiment for the BBC, so BBC Horizon. And they locked me in a nuclear bunker for 10 days, basically in the dark, no reference to time, no comms with anyone, so solitary. And that was it. Took me down, locked the door, shut me in, and then let me out 10 days later. And it was an experiment to sort of work out what happens to your circadian rhythm, so the way that your body functions when it reacts to daylight and sleep, and to what happens when you disconnect from daylight. And what happens is, we, if I get this right, we actually operate on a 24 and a bit, 25, 26 hour cycle. So instead of, You know, you go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, you wake up at 6. Your body's reset by daylight. And your daily routine, you always know what time it is. So you almost keep that 24-hour cycle. Mm. When you disconnect from time and from daylight, you slip, I think it's free, you kind of go into free run or whatever it is. But you, so if you imagine you're adding an hour to your day every day, and you're sort of, so instead of going, one night you go to bed at 10, next night it's 11, next night it's 12, next night it's 1. And so over the 10 days, you completely desync, and you're sort of, I can't remember that, is it free running? Your circadian rhythm's free running.
Okay, yeah. So you're just losing track of it all, because that daylight's not there to...
The daylight's not there to reset you, and it's a daylight that, in theory, that resets you. And when you don't have that, your body clock, your circadian rhythm doesn't reset itself. So you go into this, you're free running, basically.
Yeah. Was you trying to mitigate against it?
I wasn't, no. You can't. Right. You have no daylight. And as much as the being in the Marines helped, because I just gave myself a routine. I would try and crack a bit of fizz, but I had a room like this size with a bed. It was underground in the dark.
You're just in this size room?
Yeah.
So what, 3 metres by 2 metres?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And then I had to do experiments. They gave me sort of 7 experiments that I had to do 7 times a day. So I was sort of like writing on the wall day one and in my head sort of trying to keep track of how many days I'd been in there. But it's hard, you know, when you go to sleep and you don't have a reference to time and you wake up, you don't know how long you've been asleep. Is it 1 hour, you know, 5 hours, 12 hours? And then they would integrate jet lag phase, they called it. So they would wake me up mid-cycle. So I would fall asleep, then they'd wake me up. I'd have to stay awake for... That would be me awake for the rest of my day, whatever my day was. And so it became quite confusing. And I think I managed to get myself into the zone where I was like, it's only 10 days. I know that I'm flying to Greenland the night that I get out. So I can kind of work out, you know, after sleep cycles, how many days roughly that I'm in. Had I not been given that day, the day count of when I was supposed to be coming out, I think it would have been not long at all before I kind of unraveled in there. The 3 things that I sort of took away from that, which from a mental health point of view, is that if, from what I didn't have, they were taken away, daylight, exercise, and human interaction. Without those 3 things, I felt like I was spiraling pretty quickly. Had it not been the fact that I was getting out on day 10 and it had been an indefinite amount of time, I would have probably spiraled and broke after about 3 days. Mm. Those 3 things are so important. Daylight, get outside, exercise, speak to people. For mental health, I mean, it's probably a good base place to start if someone's feeling down or low. Is when was the last time you were outside getting stuck into some hard graft? And that, I don't mean to sound pithy when I say that, but, you know, getting out into the hills, getting out into the parks, start cracking fizz, be outside, and chatting to other people. I feel like that's quite a good place to start to then work on everything else. And even physical fitness, you know, without that mental head game. And I think this bunker kind of taught me that, or demonstrated that. You know, I completely disconnected. I was disconnected from everything. But in a way, it felt like it reconnected me in a way that I came out and I knew what I needed to do to have good head game.
Mm. It was overwhelming coming out.
Yeah, man, it's like you come out and it's like the Matrix. You can see all this. You can't see it, but you can like literally smell. If you imagine like all the, everything's in glorious technicolor, the greens, the blue sky, and you can smell almost individual plants and bees flying past. It was like a cartoon when you come out, and it's bright. You can't see
where
anything.
Where was it in the country?
In down in Devon.
Oh, was it?
Big nuclear bunker. There. It was beautiful outside.
It's grim inside.
It was just grim, dark and damp inside. But that, it was an amazing lesson for me, because I didn't do that for anyone else. I didn't do it for the BBC or for Horizon. I did it because I'm always banging on social media about, you know, because we have to have this sort of like presence about doing hard jobs and hard graft. And actually, I was like, when was the last time I was actually seriously challenged myself? And obviously, we did the row and stuff with Foxy and those guys. But I hadn't actually done something that would test me and would I break. And I was a bit nervous when I went in because I thought, this will be on television and, you know, I potentially could break. I don't understand, you know, I don't know what I'm going to have to deal with.
I mean, you look at, you know, you've even going back from when you was going with your dad, you look at the scouts, joining the Marines, being on shore, offshore with a group of people, then into the TV stuff. You then look at your environment where you're in, totally alien to you, and somewhere where you would definitely not want to be by yourself with no fresh air, no real source of exercise. And we talk about, like you said, like dictating a performance, your environment. And I want to touch on environment, right? Because TV or adventure TV may come and go really quick, but our environment is going to be around for a long time, you know.
Hopefully.
What's some of the things you've seen over the last kind of 9 years from that first volcano to kind of now? What are we seeing?
I think first of all, it's quite scary. I was even thinking about it this morning. You know, it's kind of in the back of my head the whole time. I was just putting the rubbish out in my street, live in London, putting the rubbish out. And I was thinking, you know, I was just looking at the amount of bags on the street, thinking all of this stuff for this one house, for this whole year, for the last 100 years, everything is just being buried, you know, in a hole in the ground. Essentially, most of our rubbish, plastic bags, everything is just getting buried underground in the UK. And it's difficult and it's hard not to be all consumed by it. And Steve and I have travelled to 10 countries over the last year, and that's a delicate balancing act as well. We're, you know, carbon offset. We're flying to these places. We are telling stories there about how the environment's changing, but, you know, film crews do usually have a fairly big footprint. And so we have, as a production company, completely offset all of the carbon emissions. Now, it's not the same as not doing it in the first place, but, you know, we're up there and we're, you know, it is a carbon neutral production. And that, for us, was super important. It wouldn't have happened if we weren't able to do that. And but Steve and I have seen huge changes in, you know, in the last 5 years, at least. And it's, some of them aren't subtle. Some of them are quite subtle. You know, it's speaking to some people who live on the river in the Amazon, and they say 5 years ago we were able to fish this fish here, but now we have to go to this other location to get it. Now, whether that's mercury poisoning in the river from mining, illegal mining operations, or whether that's because the temperature's risen a little bit or dropped a little bit, it's difficult to tell. Steve and I paddled across Scoresby Sund in Greenland this time last year. And it's the first time that anyone's paddled across it this time of year, because it was the earliest that the sea ice had ever broken up on record. And so these things are happening, and lots of people have lots of different views on it. But we do see it in Oman when we were filming there. Up until just 6-7 years ago, this beautiful village, these Falage systems, I think they're called, where they sort of run the water down and irrigate and grow crops. That's not been able to run for the last 4 or 5 years because there's just not enough rain there. So we do get to see it. It's hard to know what's normal, what's not normal, but what we can categorically say and we see is that in the last 5 years there has been some huge, huge changes.
I think one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast is when we first met at a Bremont event, and we was chatting about it, and we was talking. It was red hot. It was February.
It was
red hot.
It was 20 odd degrees.
Wasn't it? And everyone was going, "Oh, great it was!" And you was the opposite. You was going, "No, this is fucking scary."
Yeah,
this is scary. And I said, "Look, we're never going to be able to fill every single environmental problem in this hour. But what I want people to do is go away, see your work, what you're doing." I think it's vital. Like, communication is so important, and TV, audio, visual, whatever it is, and getting a message out there to understand what we've got, what we could potentially lose. I think it's vital. Mate, it's been a fascinating hour. and a real inspiration for me. And thank you very much.
Yeah, awesome.
We will leave it there.